From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, notorious Boston mob boss James Whitey Bulger has been found dead in prison.
He was killed in his cell last night. He didn't make roll call this morning.
Bulger was once one of America's most wanted fugitives.
It was almost like a ghostly presence. Even the cops were afraid of it.
He rose from gangster to godfather.
When Jim Bulger decided to kill somebody, he killed them. There was no change in his mind. And people knew it. And people would do what was asked of them without even meeting him because they didn't want to meet him.
All while acting as an informant for the FBI.
Isn't that the supreme irony? Whitey Bulger, New England's most notorious mobster ever, is a rat.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. Notorious Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger is dead. He was found dead at a West Virginia prison at approximately 8:20 this morning, according to the U.S. Justice Department. He was 89 years old. Bulger had just been moved to the high-security Hazleton prison. A law enforcement source speaking on the condition of anonymity told WBUR Bulger was killed in prison. The FBI is investigating. In his time, Bulger was the feared former leader of the Winter Hill Gang and once one of America's most wanted fugitives. He was charged with 19 murders and convicted in 11 of them. WBUR's David Boeri reported on Bulger's crimes.
He was one of the most feared men in the history of Boston.
When Jim Bulger decided to kill somebody, he killed them. There was no change in his mind, and people knew it.
Kevin Weeks had seen his boss at work, buried some of the victims, and testified at Bulger's trial.
People didn't want to meet him, and people would do what was asked of them without even meeting him because they didn't want to meet him.
He rose from the projects of Southie, along with his brother William, whose parallel path to power went to politics and the presidency of the state Senate, and later the University of Massachusetts. From boosting goods from the backs of trucks, Whitey Bulger graduated to bank robbery in a stint in federal prison, including Alcatraz, of which he was a proud alumnus. Back on the streets, he joined an Irish gang called Winter Hill and killed as a favor for the mafia.
Because of his viciousness and his utter ruthlessness, he became a legend in Boston.
Says former TV reporter Ron Golubin.
It was almost like a ghostly presence. Even the cops were afraid of him.
He was cunning, disciplined, and low profile. But Bulger's rise from gangster to godfather was enabled and empowered by the government's war on organized crime, in which the enemy was the mafia, the Italian-American gangsters, and not the Irish-Americans. What Boston mafia boss Gennaro Angiulo and his lieutenants did not know about their outside hitmen was this. Bulger and his partner Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy had been recruited as secret FBI informants.
Isn't that the supreme irony? Whitey Bulger, New England's most notorious mobster ever, is a rat. And the whole time, he's becoming more and more powerful with the help and aid of the FBI.
Credited inside the Justice Department with helping take out the top and middle tier of the local mafia, Bulger and Flemmy turned the Bureau into the Bulger Bureau of Investigations.
They came to him to use him as an informant, and he ended up using them as his informant and stuff. He flipped the switch.
Bulger corrupted his FBI handler, John Connolly, who grew up in the same Southie housing project. He corrupted Connolly's supervisor, John Morris. With cash, gifts, and master manipulation, Bulger compromised a number of agents who wined and dined him in their homes and in his. From them, Bulger gained intelligence about rival gangsters and surveillance operations in which he was the target. One agent gave Bulger 40 pounds of plastic explosive, according to testimony at trial. Bulger was even given the identity of people informing about him. whom he then murdered.
There are no words to describe how horrible an act that is,
observed a retired state superior court judge, Robert Barton.
There's nothing lower, there's nothing worse.
From the time he went onto the books as an FBI informant in 1975, Bulger commanded fear across the city without incurring so much as a misdemeanor until 1995. A team of state police detectives, a DEA agent, and a couple of federal prosecutors finally built a case against Bulger and overcame the entrenched opposition of the FBI. But Bulger was tipped off to his coming indictment. The heads up came from John Connolly, the star FBI agent. Off went Bulger with his longtime girlfriend, Teresa Stanley. But he soon brought her home and picked up his other girlfriend, Catherine Gregg.
The fact that he is still a fugitive after so many years is an embarrassment to every law enforcement officer that we work with.
Acknowledged one FBI supervisor, James Burkett, when Bulger had only been a fugitive for 5 years. Afterward, the local bureau tried to retract his statement. Bulger went uncaptured for 16 years. Posters of America's 10 Most Wanted pictured Bulger alongside Osama bin Laden.
This is an announcement by the FBI. Have you seen this woman? The FBI is offering $100,000 for tips leading to Catherine Grieg's whereabouts.
The astonishing break came in June 2011, after the Bureau released a public service announcement focusing on the blonde companion who was 20 years younger than Bulger. In short order, they were both captured in a rent-controlled apartment in Santa Monica. Bulger came back to a city different from the one he'd left. His brother John had done a stint in prison for lying to a grand jury when asked about Whitey. And his brother William had been forced out of office as university president after being subpoenaed to a congressional hearing and deliberately questioned in public in regard to his whereabouts.
On advice of counsel, I am unable to answer any questions today.
After he asserted his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself, William Bulger was then given immunity and forced to answer questions in a subsequent hearing in Washington in the summer of 2003. Reacting to his assertions of failed memory and apparent evasions, congressmen accused William Bulger of lying. It did not help his cause that a leaked grand jury transcript quoted him as saying he hoped his brother would never be captured. When James Bulger was put on trial in 2013, William Bulger never appeared.
There is an incredible wreckage feel that stretches from the 70s to this day,
says Ron Golubin, the former TV reporter. Though Bulger was convicted of all but one count at his trial, victims expressed frustration that those who had empowered and enabled Bulger were not held to account. The father of Tommy Donahue was gunned down by Whitey Bulger as he gave a ride home to someone who was talking to the FBI.
You know, how Whitey was able to terror everybody for 30 years, murder, manipulate, extort, and not get in trouble at all. Why the government or the FBI sat back and didn't do a damn thing about it.
It was a wreckage field that was deep and wide. And though Bulger may have been the executioner, it had started with a secret special relationship with the Justice Department. Congressman Dan Burton summarized the findings of a congressional investigation into the scandal this way.
Rogue members of the FBI up to the highest levels protected informants at the expense of innocent people. Informants committed murders with impunity. Killers were tipped off so that they could flee before being arrested.
Kevin Weeks might add this epitaph, recalling that over a span of 20 years, Whitey Bulger could wake up every day, look out his window onto Boston, and say to himself, I own this town.
And joining me now on the line from PeterSam is WBUR senior correspondent David Boeri. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Hi, so this is a developing story. Let's start with what we know. Whitey Bulger found dead at this West Virginia prison earlier this morning. What can you tell us about his death?
So Whitey Bulger arrived at the Hazleton prison in West Virginia last night. He didn't report at roll call this morning. They found him in his cell. The statement says he was unresponsive. My sources, reliable sources, tell me he was killed. But it was overnight. He was in general population, which is somewhat stunning because he was supposed to be headed to a medical facility. It had 8 heart attacks in his stint in prison in Florida, Maria, and he had complained about treatment. They had him in solitary. They had argued that he should go to a medical unit. Instead, he's in general population last night, the cell door open.
Wow. And we understand you're hearing a familiar name.
So the question asked is, you know, who would want to kill Whitey Bulger? The answer is probably a long list of people who would. A very common phenomena in prisons, especially maximum security prisons, where people are doing life in prison without the chance of parole already. The consequences of killing somebody else don't extend really effectively to any longer sentence. And so you get bragging rights. It's a common phenomenon in prison. In addition, what's ironic here, especially crazy, is that one of the inmates at that prison was tried and convicted in Boston, in a trial in Boston this year, of a murder. His name is Paul Wiedek. His co-defendant is Frank Salemi, the legendary mob boss and a rival of Bulger. And some of the speculation, the conjecture among law enforcement, and it may in fact stand up, that Frank Salemi is being investigated in this matter, which is very early on. We should point out very early on.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the beginning here. So Bulger had just been transferred to this high security prison, Hazleton. Do we know why he was transferred? Was it for medical reasons?
Well, it certainly wasn't. He wasn't going to Hazleton for medical reasons. It's not a medical unit. One of the medical units in the prison system, Federal Bureau of Prison System, one of the units, a geriatric unit, is located right in Fort Devens, Massachusetts. That's one of them. The Bulger had, as I had said earlier, 8 heart attacks alone in the prison in Florida. He was his legs were black and blue. He was in a wheelchair. He was in very bad condition. They were complaining about poor treatment through his lawyers. Was complaining about poor treatment by the prison. There was talk then, and he was of the understanding that he would be sent into a medical facility, but West Virginia is not a medical facility.
Mm-hmm. Now, you reported earlier today that there have been other deaths at Hazleton. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, if in fact Whitey Bulger was killed in Hazleton, he would be the third inmate to be killed by a fellow inmate in 6 months there.
So let's take a step back here for a minute. Bulger was 89 years old, serving 2 consecutive life sentences. Why is his death so significant?
His death is so significant because of who he was and the fact that Bulger has been present during a 6-decade era in Boston of just awe-inspiring evil and violence in law enforcement corruption, predominantly involving the FBI. There were FBI agents that were corrupted by Bulger. And Bulger was, in fact, a top echelon secret informant for the Department of Justice. And not only was he informing on fellow criminals for the purposes of advancing himself, he was not only doing that, but he had turned the Bureau into the Bulger Bureau of Information. He was getting tips from agents, from others, about coming investigations. Fellow agents and others subverted law enforcement's attempts to catch him. There's nothing worse than some of these stories involving informants, potential government witnesses being murdered on the basis of information that Bulger had gotten from law enforcement. And so that is the corruption that was staggering and went right to the core of this matter. It was called the worst law enforcement scandal in American history by a congressional committee.
You know, one FBI agent, as you've reported on, gave Bulger 40 pounds of explosives. FBI agents even gave Bulger the identity of people who were informing on him. And then he, of course, then murdered those people.
Right. And one of the fact of the matter is, in the end, many of the people, the agents, many of the people who had helped encourage, embolden, and empower him were never held to account. It was argued that the statutes of limitations had passed and they couldn't be prosecuted. It was never fully fleshed out. His relationship with the Justice Department was never fully investigated, and what it did not get laid out completely. So there's always been about this case the suspicions, the unclosed chapters. And in fact, I call it the longest running saga in the English language. Mm-hmm. It wasn't over when he was convicted. It's not over now. It never seems to end.
Mm. The web extended far beyond John Connolly, but it seems like we'll never get closure. We'll never fully know just how far the corruption went.
Yeah, and you know, I have long teeth in this story, and to people who haven't been here for a long time, it perhaps is hard to understand, but 6 decades of politics, law enforcement, culture, and even media, because the media was involved in protecting the FBI and running the FBI stories, and often involved in inaccurate stories that covered up what was really going on. That 6 decades across a broad spectrum, not just of Boston, but greater Boston and Massachusetts, were involved in this FBI special relationship with Bulger and the protection he got.
Mm. The murders Bulger was found responsible for were in the 1970s and 80s. I mean, this was a very particular era. Would you say Boston was a different city in those days? Can you paint
many
us a
ways
picture?
A different, yeah, many ways a different city, a city of grifters. It was a different place for law enforcement, to be sure, and the crime rackets, to be sure. You know, he really could look out there and say, I own this town. He really could do that.
Hmm.
And yet, some of that's still in play because it's never been fully aired out. It's never been fumigated. After Bulger fled Massachusetts, and the scandal of that, the fact that he was tipped off to his indictment, allegedly by a fellow, by a former FBI agent, who got the information from an FBI supervisor. Even that is stunning when you think of it. The cross-country run, 16 years on the lam, with an investigation that was often criticized for being either inefficient, indifferent, or intentional in protecting him. All of that. He comes back in 2011. The trial goes on. He wants to make his defense, and he threatens to name names and talk about his special deal with the FBI. He's not allowed to do that by a judge after motions filed by the prosecution. So even then, we came away after that trial still wanting answers. The families of his victims wanting answers, and actually, in one stunning setting, cheering on the defense of the man who had killed their loved ones, because they thought that the defense was more likely to open up the truth of what had happened and to get the information from the witnesses than the prosecutors themselves.
You know, many people ask how he was able to elude the law so long. You know, why wasn't he caught earlier? He had a recognizable face. He was one of America's most wanted. How did he get away from the law for more than a decade and a half?
Well, that's the question. Those are the questions about whether the FBI really wanted to get him or not. And for all those times, it was like, where's Waldo? It became, you know, it became a buzz line. People ask me, I was on this case I've been covering this for about 27 years now. And people would say, where is he? Where do you think he is? It was a national, it was a local conversation, to be sure. Where's Whitey? And I went out and followed leads in California that I found out the FBI had never followed, obvious leads, doing work they never did. There was the suggestion that Bulger was crossing over the Mexican border to get drugs for his heart condition on the other side. I went to the border. I talked to Border Patrol and Immigration. and Customs, asked them if the FBI had ever come to them and shown them posters and asked them to be on the lookout for this guy, Whitey Bulger, crossing the Bureau. They told me the Bureau had never been there, never made contact, never brought posters, even though there was a poster present in one of those offices of a former top 10 most wanted who lived in Tijuana, who had been arrested by those very people as he was crossing the border.
Now, earlier you said that we still need answers, even after the trial. Family members want answers. Can you go through some of the specifics that you want answers to?
To what extent, I mean, this is the question, to what extent was he protected? To what extent? Mm. How far up the chain? How many people were involved in protecting him, in benefiting from him, of taking gifts and money? How far did it go? Were there other people? Bulger once bragged that at any point in time, he could go to the FBI office and get six guys wow. out of the FBI office to go with him on a hit with machine guns. This is what Kevin Weeks, his surrogate son and partner, told me, that Bulger used to brag that he could do that. Well, wouldn't you like to know who he claimed he could do that with? Hmm. He said he bribed several dozen Boston cops along the way. Wouldn't you like to know who he allegedly bribed? All those questions never went answered. Never went answered.
Yeah, he was convicted of participating in 11 murders, but you spoke with an associate of his once who told you that Bulger had told him he had murdered up to 37 people.
He and his partner, Stephen Fleming, were both, they liked to kill people, and they killed a lot of them.
Hmm. So take us through his rise in the underworld. He was born in the projects of South Boston, as you said in your report, and found his way to the Winter Hill Gang.
Best thing that ever happened to Bulger. He was his first arrest. They got him for jumping on the backs of trucks. Those were the early days when he was a kid. And suddenly he goes from that. His first arrest, I think, was 47. But he goes from that suddenly to doing bank jobs, armed robberies, and he got away with three armed robberies. They arrested him. He went to prison in 1956. That was probably the best thing that ever happened to him, because had he stayed out, he wouldn't have been. He was a nobody still at the scene. He didn't have any status, but had he stayed out, he most probably would have gotten killed in the gang wars of the late 50s, early 60s, in which Boston was portrayed by Life magazine as murder capital USA. There were the wars between the Irish gangs. He would have been in the line of sight. But instead, he was at federal prison, got an early release, and in signs of what was to come, he got favorable treatment or consideration from the local congressman, John McCormick, who happened to be or become the Speaker of the House.
Hmm.
So he had high-level friends or people to advocate for him. He got out of prison after the gang wars had ended and then started rising through the ranks of this group in Somerville, located on Winter Hill, that took on either the name of Winter Hill or of, in fact, its first boss, mob boss named Winter.
And David, are we a different city today? Could we imagine crime gangs of this type again, or law enforcement agencies protecting them? Maybe not to the extent that they did for Bulger.
What took place then and what take place now are starkly different. Starkly different. It really was a city of grifters, and that world has changed. There are high rises across this city. The look of the city's been transformed. The culture of the city has changed. Demographically, things have changed. All that has changed. And Bulger was there at the beginning. He's here now. And even after his death, he's going to be with us for a long time to come.
Okay. Thank you so much, David, for joining us. We appreciate it. And stay on the line with us. We are going to be joined right now. We have on the line Steve Davis, the brother of Deborah Davis. Stephen, the rifleman, Fleming's girlfriend, who was killed in 1981 when she was 26 years old. Bulger was charged with that, but not convicted of strangling and killing Deborah. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know this must be a difficult time. I just wonder what's going through your mind today?
Mixed emotions, mixed thoughts, mixed feelings. You have all this information coming in, but, you don't know how to deal with it. It's coming from the FBI. FBI down people that we can't trust as it is because of what they put all the families in Massachusetts through the hands of Whitey and the FBI themselves, local law officials and state and federal, just so dirty with the politics back then. And, I'm going to believe what they have to say now. I have to, and it'll come to light when see pictures of him on a slab or in the morgue and, coming out of the prison or whatever it might take. But, these are this is all just a story and in words. You believe what you can until you have the proof for yourself. It's how I look at it.
Our reporter David Boeri was just saying that there are many unanswered questions in this story. Do you have questions that you still want answers for?
No, it's just, you like to see the truth be told, and, there's been so many lies that the truth of lies become a lie. It's never ending, with lies. You get stuck for words when I'm asked certain questions.
Do you feel your family ever got the justice you deserved for your sister?
Would never get the justice we deserved for my sister. The family has been torn apart over it. He's ruined a lot of people, and it's a wound that'll never heal. It's something that'll never heal or never go away. And this is one of them, and and everyone out there that lost a loved one or family members dealing with the same thing. And it's easy to ask, will you ever forgive? Will you ever forget? Does it get easier? No, it don't get easier. It never will get easier.
Maria, can I make a point? Steve, you're listening to Steve Davis's story, and there's so many stories like Steve is telling of heartbreak involving his mother and his families and the other victims of Bulger's victims. And they were never told the truth. They filed lawsuits. They were never told the truth of what happened. And then in just an outrageous sense of hypocrisy, you had one branch of the Justice Department that was prosecuting Bulger and his associates. And you had the civil side arguing that the same witnesses that the government was using to criminally prosecute Bulger had no credibility. And so the stories were dismissed on the civil side by the Department of Justice lawyers taking the position, no, they're not credible. And yet the prosecutors were using those people as witnesses to convict him. It is stunning in the hypocrisy of all this. And I remember, Steve, it was the son of one of the victims who said to me afterwards, Steve Fleming and Bulger are monsters. But what I know is that that monster, Steve Flemmi, apologized to me in court, whereas the head of the FBI, Bob Mueller, never said, "I'm sorry," never expressed his condolences or regrets to the families.
Never. And as a matter of fact, I brought his name up again because I was sitting at a friend's house, and this was a very disturbing day for me, right? I'm sitting at a friend's house, and she brought up that, can you imagine that the president's having trouble with this Robert Mueller or Mueller? I can't pronounce his name, but I says, yeah, it's a big deal. She said, that's the same son of a bitch that was involved with the running the FBI in Massachusetts back then. I said, you got to be kidding me. I thought so, but I would have thought he had died. And I couldn't believe it. And I said, these are the people that, Dave, I just want to say I miss you. I haven't seen you talk to you in a while.
Well, no, we've been on, Maria, as you can understand, there are people, we have been together on this story. People have been, this goes back decades and decades. And, you know, I tell people it's a case, the story never ends, the crime never dies.
And I just want to say this, like, they say, is it the chapter over? I says, no. I mean, as a matter of fact, one closes and one opens, because this was the chapter. I have the Berkowitz boys. They're going to be producing a scripted script that we have for the trial of Bulger and the FBI and all that. We're bringing that whole thing, nonfiction, to they're shopping it right now as we speak.
And who did you say, Steve, is producing that script?
Benjamin and Max Berkowitz.
Okay. And Steve, you've been living...
I've never heard of the family.
You've been living with this loss for a long time, Steve. What's the next chapter for you? I mean, I know you say that there's no closure in this one, but can you start another chapter?
Another chapter, I'd have to say, is... I don't even know how to word that. Chapter. I just go on. I try to put all that behind me. If our project goes through, all said and done, it'd be nice to work on it and to show the people of the politics and all the corruption with the FBI, local officials, state that interfered with a lot of honest and legitimate law enforcement to do their job properly, and you had a fistful of dirt bags that were, you know, ruining a lot of people, a lot of families, and a lot of kids. And the only chapter I want to fulfill and get through is to make this happen and show the people of all the hurt and everything that we went through in the trial with all the corruption that caused these guys to do what they did. Because I don't believe any man out there would have been able to run the streets the way they did. If you listen to David, run the streets the way they did without permission, I'd have to say.
Okay, Steve
because
Davis.
Every time they did something... They got John Connolly and his crew were covering it up.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. That's Steve Davis, brother of Deborah Davis. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. And thank you, David Boeri, WBUR senior correspondent, for joining us. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. As we've been hearing this hour on the show, James Whitey Bulger, once one of the nation's most wanted fugitives, was found dead at a West Virginia prison, according to federal officials. He had just been moved to a high-security prison, and a law enforcement source, speaking on the condition of anonymity, told WBUR that Bulger was killed in prison. For another perspective on this, let's turn to Dick Lair. He's a former reporter for the Boston Globe and author of the book Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and a Devil's Deal. He's also a journalism professor at Boston University. Dick Lair, welcome.
Hi, Maria.
Dick, what's your immediate reaction to the news today?
Well, surprise. Obviously, it's a sudden death and seems to be a violent one. But it's, you know, it was the kind of story that you expected to come one day or another, given his age and his health conditions and his track record as a killer.
Mm-hmm. You know, Bulger was one of the most feared men in Boston. He had avoided prison for decades, but was convicted in 2013 of participating in those 11 murders. And he was serving two consecutive life sentences. Dick, remind our listeners of the horrific crimes he was convicted of.
Well, he was convicted of just about everything imaginable, from the murders that you mentioned to shakedowns and extortion and loan sharking, drug trafficking, again, the whole range of criminal activity. But the thing that I think that, you know, everyone has to remember is that Whitey Bulger, you know, obviously lived a very long life in a career where longevity is not usually that typical. And part of it was that he was a protective informant for the Boston Bureau of the FBI for a couple of decades.
Yeah, so not only was he an informant, but he was in part protected, also edified by the FBI. Tell us about that relationship.
Well, absolutely. And it was the late 1980s when the Globe Spotlight team, of which I was a member, you know, reported and disclosed for the first time this, what became known as the Unholy Alliance between the crime boss, Whitey Bulger, and the Boston FBI agents, where over time, you know, initially the FBI had enlisted Bulger to give him criminal information, mainly about the mafia. But over time, Bulger turned the tables, and he transformed the organized crime unit in the Boston office into, in effect, an extension of his own gang, where they were tipping him off to investigations, to other underworld figures who were informing against him. And that led to some of those informants' deaths. So it's really a horrifying chapter in the FBI's history, given that it didn't involve a single moment or a single case, but had become a way of life.
I want to talk a little bit about the narrative that he formed throughout his life. He was so purposeful about creating this myth around him, this aura about him. He was so aware that he needed to be liked to be successful. Can you elaborate on that part of him?
Well, there was the Whitey cult, so to speak, because in his gang, as powerful as it was, he never cultivated any successors or anything like that. It was always all about him. He was at the center of it all. And he could be persuasive, charming, pretend. It was almost he had a politician's touch. He would make you think he cared about you, but he didn't. He just cared about himself. And the moment you did something to cross him, you better watch out. And you know, that's really how, you know, he carried himself throughout.
I think that sort of dichotomy is what has created this sort of lore around him as well. This image that he created where, you know, he was the guy who helped senior citizens carry their groceries into their home. He was the guy who cried when a puppy died, but also the man who murdered people viciously. And that sort of duality has created this myth around him.
Right. No, he was, I think most people would agree, a classic psychopath who was a narcissistic and ultimately cared just about himself. And those gestures he made that you just mentioned that seemed helpful and genuine were really self-serving to the fullest. I mean, he was creating a zone of comfort and protection in his immediate world where people would think well of him. And myths grew up around him, for example, and they were cultivated by his corrupt handlers at the FBI, that, you know, the biggest one being that he kept drugs out of Southie. Well, the truth is completely opposite. I mean, he was getting a cut of all the drugs that were moving through Southie. So, you know, that's the kind of evil that was in play here.
Hmm. Yeah. So he was on the run for 16 years, and his brother was Senate president here in Massachusetts. Now, as you were mentioning, this is a stain on the FBI in the city, and it's easy to think that this was a Boston bygone, but how deep did it all go? And tell us again, elaborate for us, what the city was like then.
Well, yeah, I mean, he became the most powerful criminal in the city from the mid-70s on with the help of a handful of agents in the Boston office of the FBI. You know, it was like the city was theirs. You had the star agent named John Conley, who's in prison today, who had recruited him and was his so-called handler. And the city was their oyster.
Now, you've reported on and spoken with families impacted by Bulger and his crime organization. Tell us again, who were some of these victims, and did their families really feel a sense of justice after his conviction in 2013?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask the families. As far as for some of them, they never knew what happened to their relative, their father or their brother, because of Bulger would bury them along the Neponset River, and their bodies remained undiscovered until one of Whitey's henchmen, Kevin Weeks, showed them where the bodies were buried. I think it was a big moment, of course, because he was a fugitive for so many years. I think 2011 was, you know, the big moment when Whitey was finally captured in Santa Monica, where he'd been, you know, living under the radar. And then, you know, obviously bringing him back to Boston and the trial in 2013, another big moment. But, you know, I can't speak for someone who's lost a father to his violence, as you know, whether now with the death of Bulger it brings final peace. I just don't know.
In your view, who would want Bulger dead?
Well, sourced reports are referring to it might be someone, a fellow inmate with mafia ties. And it's almost like, you know, the mafia and elephants never forget, because it was Bulger's and his partner Steve Flemmy's cooperation and informing with the Boston FBI office that helped bring down the Angiulo mafia crime family. So there's always been speculation and wondering whether the mafia put a target on his back. And and like I said, it seems if this is true, that there was an inmate with mafia ties who was responsible for this death, then yeah, it's like the mafia and elephants never forget.
Right. Well, hearing you speak about this, you know, it's sobering that these underground connections are still very much active. What came of those connections between Bulger and the FBI? Did anything change for the FBI? Did the culture of the FBI change after Bulger?
We hope so. You know, following the scandal, which was the worst informant scandal in the Bureau's history. And there were congressional hearings and there were federal court hearings in the late 90s here in Boston. Certain reforms to better monitor an informant relationship between an agent and a criminal were implemented. But it all comes down to the people on the ground and the supervisors. You know, no, it doesn't matter how good it reads on paper, the checks and balances. It's the execution.
Mm-hmm. In your view, did Bulger... Do you think he created a narrative around Boston? Do you think he...
I mean, during his lifetime?
Yeah, during his lifetime.
Well, you know, for the longest time, I'm not sure, because I think it was Boston. He was always just a local, you know, killer and gangster and crime boss. It was only, I think, after, the, you know, the FBI piece. It's the FBI that's a national organization. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways, when that scandal broke, that elevated Whitey. I mean, that's where... You know, we wrote a biography that's a sequel to Black Mask called America's Most Notorious Crime Boss. And the reason why is, you know, the FBI in some ways elevated it to historic proportions because pick your crime boss, Al Capone, John Gotti, John Dillinger, they're all infamous and notorious in their own ways, but none of them did what Whitey did. And that's bringing the FBI to its knees.
Do you think this brings some closure to this chapter of Boston's history, or do you think... It reminds us of the wounds, but doesn't really heal anything.
Well, I think it does both. Obviously, we're talking. It reminds us of who Bulger is and the incalculable harm he caused to not just families, of his victims, but also to the city at large, and especially to law enforcement. And it's something, you know, that's not something we should ever forget going forward. But, you know, okay, there is closure here. He's dead now.
Mm. Dick Lehr is the author of Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and A Devil's Deal. He's also a journalism professor at Boston University. Dick Lehr, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Stay with us. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. All this hour, we've been following the story that James Whitey Bulger, one of Boston's most notorious criminals, has died. The U.S. Justice Department confirmed Bulger's body was found around 8:20 this morning in Hazleton, a high-security prison in West Virginia, where he had recently been moved. Speaking on the condition of anonymity, a law enforcement source told WBUR that Bulger was killed. The FBI is investigating. 89-year-old Bulger was convicted in 2013 on multiple charges, including his role in 11 murders. And for decades, Bulger led the Winter Hill Gang that dominated Boston's underworld. Joining me on the line for more is Boston Globe Deputy City Editor Mike Bello. Mike, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon.
So the Globe is covering this very intensely. What's the very latest on Bulger's death?
Well, we're reporting this afternoon, Shelley Murphy and Kevin Cullen have a story on our bostonglobe.com website saying that three people briefed on the situation, speaking on the condition of anonymity, are saying a fellow inmate with mafia ties was being investigated in connection with Bulger's death at the U.S. penitentiary in Hazleton. Authorities are not formally commenting on this. All we know is the U.S. Bureau of Prisons statement that Bulger arrived at the Hazleton prison on Monday and was found unresponsive today and was pronounced dead by the Preston County Medical Examiner. Amazingly, we did get a hold of Bulger's brother, John, on a telephone interview where he said the family had not been officially notified of the death. Later, he was confronted by reporters at William Bulger's house, the former Senate president. John was trying to reach out to his brother, and apparently his brother wasn't there. And John was saying he knew that Whitey Bulger had been sick for a while, but did not know anything about the death and did not have any further comment at that time. We're obviously working all kinds of sources in the thing, trying to figure out what happened. We did talk to the president of the American Federation of Government Employees in charge of people running guards at the prison. They're saying there's previous problems at USP Hazleton. They've had two other deaths this year. Bulger's death is the third death. Complained of understaffing, people are concerned about that. Some people have called for an investigation. The FBI right now is doing a formal investigation along with the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Northern District of West Virginia into the death of James Bulger.
Right. And we heard from WBUR senior correspondent David Boeri earlier, who told us that Paul Wiedek, another convicted killer from Boston, is also being held at that facility. Now, Mike, I wonder, in Boston's history of crime, in your opinion, where does Whitey Bulger fit? Why does this story still resonate so much?
I think Bulger had a tremendous hold on the city, on the criminal underworld for so long. First working with the mafia and Frank Salemi at one point, and then seeking to undermine the mafia and power grab for the Winter Hill Gang and them gaining control of much of the criminal activity in Boston. So for 30-some-odd years, Whitey Bulger had a reign of terror among the underworld, among victims. I mean, he's charged with 11 murders, but, probably was responsible for perhaps a two dozen, if not more. So it was tremendous fear in the underworld. You know, I remember working at the Herald before I was at the Globe, and people, when you talked about Whitey Bulger and Senate President Bulger, people were fearful of mentioning them in the same breath.
Yeah, and Mike, we're running out of time here. I just want to ask you, in his tenure as one of Boston's toughest criminals, many people believe Bulger committed, many more crimes than he was ultimately convicted for. Are there any details you're hoping to learn, any questions you're still seeking answers to, when we have just a few seconds left?
It's really hard to say the extent of what he did, but certainly victims want that, and I know the U.S. Attorney's Office will not rest until they solve all any unsolved murders that may have been linked to Bill Bodger. Certainly investigation in his criminal activities is not over.
Okay. Boston Globe Deputy City Editor Mike Bello, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Maria Garcia. Thanks for joining us.